This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The development of natural gas has exploded in the United States over the past decade. Technical advances like hydraulic fracking fueled the boom for the oil and gas industry. But with this rapid increase comes widespread debate. Proponents tout economic and energy security benefits. Critics point out health and environmental consequences. Daniel Ramey outlines both sides of the issue in his new book, The Fracking Debate: The Risks, Benefits, and Uncertainties of the Shale Revolution. He's a senior research associate at Resources for the Future, also teaches energy policy at the University of Michigan, and joins us now. Daniel Ramey, welcome.
Thank you so much, Frank. It's great to be with you.
Your interest in the topic actually starts in Durham, North Carolina. Tell us about it.
It does. So I grew up in Durham, where my parents have both been music professors at Duke for their entire careers. So I grew up in the community and ended up going to graduate school in public policy at Duke. In between my first and second years of graduate school, where I was getting a master's degree, I interned with the State Department of Environment and Natural Resources. It's not called that anymore, but the agency essentially still exists. And during my internship, the state legislature asked the department to write a report on the potential impacts of shale gas development in North Carolina. So I raised my hand and I volunteered to write a section of that report. And for some reason, they allowed me to do it. And I ended up working on the project for a couple of years and have continued to pursue it ever since.
At that point, what did you find, or what were the findings of that report?
That particular report focused on the relatively modest resources of shale gas that North Carolina possesses in the Triassic basins in the central part of the state around Sanford, as well as some deposits around Winston-Salem. And my focus of the report was on the potential social impacts of oil and gas development. So looking at how communities might be affected by traffic or crime or other quality of life issues when oil and gas development occurs. And they can be affected in a number of ways, through heavy truck traffic and workers potentially coming in from out of state. And we have seen some of those impacts in communities where oil and gas development has taken place. However, in North Carolina, the scale of the shale resources are quite small, and the likelihood of high-scale oil and gas development happening in North Carolina anytime soon are extremely remote.
So we should talk about now what fracking is and how it works. Give us an overview.
Sure. So fracking is short for hydraulic fracturing. Hydraulic fracturing is a process that happens after an oil and gas well has been drilled. It can be used for either oil or natural gas. And hydraulic fracturing involves mixing large volumes of water, typically millions of gallons, along with sand and proprietary chemicals. And that mixture is injected deep underground into shale rock formations or other rock formations. And the injection of that fluid is called a well stimulation technique. That's what the industry will call it. And they've been using different types of well stimulation techniques since their inception, really, since the 1850s in Pennsylvania. And hydraulic fracturing is one particular type of well stimulation technique that has been extremely successful, in part because it's been combined with a number of other technologies, including very precise horizontal drilling, really high-quality underground seismic mapping. And these technologies have combined to allow the United States to dramatically increase its natural gas and its oil production in the last 5 years or so. The U.S. is actually on track to surpass its all-time oil production highs probably in the next couple of months or so. So hydraulic fracturing is an important technology, but it's not the only technology that's been employed to dramatically increase oil and gas production in the United States.
All right. So let's talk about this, because it's a way of getting natural gas, and sort of one of the immediate benefits of this, you would think, is, well, if we could get more natural gas out of the ground, because the problem is that stuff has been locked up. You're opening holes in the shale and allowing this stuff to pass freely by these injections and then sort of keeping it open with the sand and the fluids, right? That's the idea. And why would you do this? Well, for one reason, if you can replace coal. You don't have to burn as much coal if you burn natural gas. And we know that when it comes to fossil fuels, if you're having to choose among fossil fuels, you would rather burn natural gas than coal. Am I right?
That's right. I think from multiple perspectives. So there's kind of a public health perspective here, and there's also a climate change perspective. The public health perspective is that coal-fired power plants emit a number of air pollutants that contribute to tens of thousands of premature deaths each year. So to the extent that natural gas displaces coal in the electricity sector, that's a benefit for public health. On the other side of the coin, those living close to oil and gas production activities might be exposed to some chemicals that are emitted during the well drilling or hydraulic fracturing processes, and that can pose a health risk for those living close by, very close by to oil and gas wells.
What about these?
Moving over to.
Well, let me stop you there for one moment, and then I'll have you move. But what about the escape of methane and natural gas in the process itself?
Right. That's been a really important part of the debate, and there's been a lot of study of that particular issue over the last 5 years or so. The U.S. EPA has estimates for how much methane escapes from oil and natural gas systems around the United States. But about 5 years ago, a study came out that called those estimates into question. And partly because of that study, there was a raft of new research that came online. And researchers have been scouring oil and gas producing regions, taking measurements, trying to understand exactly how much methane is being emitted from these oil and gas wells. It's worth saying that methane is the primary component of natural gas, and when it's burned, it produces carbon dioxide, heat, and water. But if it's not burned and it simply floats into the atmosphere, its climate impact is far more powerful than carbon dioxide alone. And when you look at the breadth of the research on this topic, there have been some studies that find very high methane emissions rates from particular natural gas or oil-producing fields, such as a certain part of Utah or a couple parts of Colorado. But more studies actually find relatively low methane emissions rates. And if you look across the breadth of the research, it seems pretty compelling to me, based on the breadth of the evidence, that the level of methane emissions is not high enough to negate natural gas's climate benefit relative to coal.
All right, now let's talk about some of the local issues. You were about to finish, you know, sort of the on the one hand and on the other, with the mining of this, and I think maybe you were talking about some of the people living very close to the wells and some of the particular hazards that they may face under some circumstances.
That's right. One of the perspectives that I try to bring to this book is the local perspective. And I have been working on a research project with my colleague Richard Newell at Resources for the Future for several years, where we look very closely at localities and how they have been affected by oil and gas development around the United States. And so as part of that research, I've actually literally visited every major oil and gas play in the United States over the last few years, some of them multiple times. And what you tend to find is that individuals living in and around these oil and gas producing regions have a more nuanced view of the industry than many who live further away. And there's actually research that supports that, showing that the further you get from oil and gas producing regions, the more likely people's views of the industry are to be shaped by simple party affiliation, where Republicans tend to be more supportive and Democrats tend to be less supportive. And my takeaway from my personal experience in these producing regions, as well as from the academic research, is that individuals living near oil and gas production, they have a nuanced view of the benefits and the risks. They understand that there are risks of living very close to oil and gas production because of some of the air emissions and other concerns that can arise from being so close to all this industrial activity. At the same time, they're reaping economic benefits from the industry's presence. And so many of the conversations that I've had with people over the last several years that I try to reflect in the book really convey that mix of the idea that there are both benefits and costs for local communities.
Yeah, and it's interesting when you think about local, we may need a behavioral psychologist to weigh in on this one. But if you think about people who live in coal country who really adamantly want to continue mining coal, and when you think about the health hazards that they face daily and the impact it has on their health, education, and welfare. If you were an outsider, you would say, my goodness, don't you want to get out of this industry that causes asthma and black lung disease? But you become attached in ways that are hard to explain. And as I say, we may need a behavioral psychologist. But let's talk more about these kinds of identity attachments, but talk more about the economic benefits, upside and downside to continuing to produce hydraulically fractured gas?
There are substantial economic benefits and there are economic risks of heavy reliance on this industry. So again, my travels to, you know, places in West Texas or in the Bakken region of North Dakota or parts of Oklahoma or California or Alaska, what you find is that communities, many communities, are seeing enormous short-term economic benefits from the presence of the oil and gas industry. Lots of investment flowing into these communities, lots of employment opportunities, high wages. I talked to many people who expressed the idea that, you know, their children are not going to move away from rural North Dakota anymore because they have these employment opportunities. And so there are unexpected benefits to families and communities because of the investment occurring through this industry. But at the same time, oil and gas prices are notoriously volatile. They can go up and down in very unpredictable ways. And for communities that are heavily reliant on the oil and gas industry as their primary economic driver, that volatility creates real challenges, real planning challenges, both for business owners as well as for local governments who are trying to manage and think about the long-term implications of being so heavily reliant on this economic sector.
And you talked about that, too, in another kind of in another context, which is the fact that this does tend to bring down the cost of fossil fuels by producing more, by having a greater supply. You talk about the happy hour effect that it has on our consumption, right?
That's right. So I tell a story in the book about one of my favorite hours of the day, which is happy hour. And happy hour is a time when people will tend to drink a little more because drinks cost a little less. And the basic idea is the same really for any consumer good or commodity, and it's held true for oil and natural gas. So the shale revolution has, as I mentioned earlier, dramatically increased domestic natural gas and oil production, and that increase has contributed substantially to the lower gasoline prices that Americans are paying today, to the lower energy bills for heating, as well as for electricity that anyone who uses natural gas in their home is experiencing. On average, households are have saved over $1,000 per household because of the shale revolution. And those benefits are substantial. At the same time, those lower energy prices encourage people to use more energy, and that tends to increase emissions. Now, there have been a number of studies that actually try to take into account several of the issues that you and I have been talking about so far, Frank, the issue of methane emissions, the issue of reduced carbon dioxide emissions, as well as this happy hour effect that we're talking about. And what they tend to find is that over the short term, shale development has been a clear benefit for U.S. greenhouse gas emissions. U.S. greenhouse gas emissions are way down since their historical peaks in the first decade of the 2000s. But over the longer term, what you find is that shale development probably doesn't increase or decrease long-term greenhouse gas emissions by all that much. And so to bend the greenhouse gas curve downward, as we will need to do to reach the climate targets that governments have agreed to in the Paris Agreement and other international agreements, will require strong government policy, ideally at the federal level, to really change the trajectory of United States greenhouse gas emissions with or without the shale revolution.
Well, and so that leads to what some might call sort of an opportunity cost to some extent, that this extends the ability of this extends the life expectancy, the lifespan of fossil fuels. We know it's limited and we know it'll come to an end. And if it doesn't come to an end without a robust development of alternative fuels, it'll lead to a crisis. I mean, I think is that a fair sort of analysis that someday we're going to be off fossil fuels. And if we can't supply our energy needs completely by something else, prices are going to go up and there'll be some trouble, right?
That's true over the very long run. But I guess the way that I think about it is that with this low-cost supply of natural gas that's been enabled by the shale revolution, there are two major effects, and one of them is what you're talking about, where natural gas competes with lower carbon sources such as wind or solar. And so you need policy to ensure that over the longer term, we continue to bend that CO2 trajectory downwards. But in the next 10 or 20 years, the United States still gets about 30% of its electricity from coal-fired power. power. And displacing coal-fired power by natural gas today is an extremely cheap and extremely cost-effective thing to do. So the shale revolution, I think, provides an opportunity for federal policymakers in particular to implement climate policies that can reduce emissions in the near term at low cost. And then as we think towards the decades to come, additional measures will be necessary to further reduce greenhouse gas emissions.
What would that look like in terms of government policy? Does that include some form of incentive? In other words, some way of investing in the development of renewables to do that now while we have this opportunity?
Most of the research on the sort of most efficient way to reach greenhouse gas reduction goals and certain climate targets, they tend to involve two major components. The first of which is pricing greenhouse gas emissions, either through a carbon tax or something like a cap and trade system. And there are a variety of ways you can do that, and some of them have been proposed at the federal level, but none of them have been implemented to date. It seems unlikely that it's going to be implemented under the current administration, but you never know. So along with pricing carbon emissions and gradually increasing that price to reduce greenhouse gas emissions in the near term, it's also the research also suggests that investing in research and development for the technologies of tomorrow can be one of the most cost-effective ways to spend our dollars today. And that includes to some extent wind and solar, but wind and solar are relatively mature technologies. There are other technologies that are, you know, on the drawing board today and that are still at their pilot stages that government could continue to invest in and really try to produce the energy technologies of tomorrow.
Well, let me ask you how you feel about this after having studied it and taking a very deep and scholarly approach to the arguments pro and con. How you feel about the development of shale technology and the likelihood that we would take this opportunity to do the things you say, to develop a government policy that will take advantage of this moment so that we're ready for the time when fossil fuels are no longer plausible?
Well, it certainly seems in the near term that a comprehensive type of climate policy is unlikely at the federal level. However, there are a variety of positive actions that are being taken by state governments around the United States, states like California, Washington State, Oregon, several states in the northeastern part of the United States are implementing and have implemented pretty robust policies to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Both from the electric sector as well as from other parts of the economy. And those really are positive steps. My thinking is that most companies, including large utilities and even oil companies, are actually planning for a day when greenhouse gas pricing will become a real thing in the United States. It's certainly the reality in most of the rest of the world that governments are acting to curb these emissions. Maybe not to the extent that we would want, but there at least is a recognition that something needs to happen on this front. And so the availability of low-cost natural gas, regardless of which administration is in power, I think makes it less costly and easier to implement those types of policies. But whether or not they do get implemented depends much more on the prevailing political winds, which are much harder to predict.
But let me ask you just one more question along those lines, which is that right now the oil and gas industry has used most of its weight and wealth to kind of persuade governments not to impose these kinds of restrictions and policies. And that's because they've been able to fall back on cheap prices. So there's really been no pressure on these governments to do it. Doesn't fracking present a kind of moral hazard, a sense that we can get away with it, and we buy their arguments when they press us not to impose these policies quite yet?
I'm not sure if I would see it that way. I think it certainly seems to be the case that in previous decades, some oil companies have been less than helpful in dealing with the climate change challenge. But today, if you look at the sort of public statements of these companies, there's a clear acknowledgement that climate change is a problem, and many of them argue that natural gas can be part of the solution. I would tend to agree with that view, at least in the near term. Again, in the long term, we do need more ambitious efforts to deal with this challenge. But in the near term, it seems to me that natural gas can continue to be part of the solution, even though it does present some of these moral hazard issues that you raise, where down the line, having low-cost natural gas creates challenges for other technologies, such as wind and solar and other technologies of the future.
Daniel Ramey, author of The Fracking Debate, Risks, Benefits, and Uncertainties of the Shale Revolution, going to be doing book talks and signings January 5th at the Duke University campus. Daniel, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Frank.
You can find out more about the book at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, a new art exhibit draws inspiration from music, Maya Angelou, and the Me Too movement. That's next. Stay with us.